I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Yancey Strickler, co-founder of Kickstarter, a leading crowdfunding site. The company enables the public to fund creative projects related to film, food, design, and music. So if you're a musician who wants to create an independent album, you can go to Kickstarter, describe your project, how much money you need, and hope that visitors to the site will contribute. Yancey co-founded the company in 2009 with Perry Chen and Charles Adler. Welcome.
Thank you.
When you were growing up, did you have a sense that you would be an entrepreneur?
Never. My entire goal growing up was to be a writer. I loved to read. I was always good at school, you know, but my dream was to be a writer. And, you know, there were various books that made me want to do that. All the President's Men was a book I reread all the time, and I very desperately wanted that kind of experience. And that's what I pursued through college. And, you know, I took it very seriously, and I got my first freelance writing jobs during college. And after school, I became a writer full time. And that was sort of living the dream, moving here to New York and doing that. And then I think there's a certain point where I realized that that world is a little small for me, that maybe I was better at more things beyond just writing and thinking about language and how to write about music or whatever the topic was. And so I sort of realized I started working in companies and organizations that I thrived in those situations, that I could be decisive, I knew how to do various things. But, you know, this whole thing with Kickstarter just sort of fell into it.
What do your parents do? Are they in the literary field?
Not at all. I mean, my father's sells furniture. My mother was a secretary. She recently went back to school and now is an accountant. My stepfather's a auto mechanic, and my stepmother sells real estate. So it's a working class family. I grew up certainly not having money in a very rural area in Southwest Virginia, outside of Blacksburg, Virginia, where Virginia Tech is. And it's a great place to grow up. But nothing about it would lead me to where I've gotten to be now. I think that, you know, growing up in a small town like that, you're unaware of how big the rest of the world is. And, you know, fortunately, through books and all these other ways, I got this greater sense of what possibility there was.
You grew up on a farm. Who was the farmer?
Well, we rented a house. There's this old house built in 1863, I think it was. It's a white house with a red tin roof, and you could see the house from about 5 miles away because the roof would just pop out of the trees. It was kind of nice. But it was this falling down house, and we just rented it. Our family did for $100 a month, and farmers worked the land. So I would work for them during the summers, but they would raise cattle there, and they're, you know, cattle for beef, so they would take them away, and you'd hear the rest of the cows cry, you know, that mm-hmm. night. And there was, you know, there was sort of a rhythm to it. It's a nice thing to talk about now, being in New York, because it makes me exotic, but I hated it at the time. I mean, I just wanted to read books and, you know, think about things like that. I did not thrive on country living. But I look back at it now with some level of fondness.
So the farming life wasn't for you, and you wanted to be a writer. Did your parents ever push back on that?
Not at all. I was never pressure whatsoever. I think if anything, my father wanted me to be a rock star, so it might have been the opposite direction.
But. Speaking of rock star, you have an interest in music. You were a music journalist or a music critic prior to starting Kickstarter. What role did music play in your life?
It was huge. I mean, my father wanted to be a musician his entire life. He was a folk artist, and he had bands. I played very briefly in a band with him when I was in high school, a band called Rock Bottom, which is kind of appropriately named. But music was always, you know, was my identity, you know, and I was a weird kid in high school, and, you know, I was one of those kids. But music is where I saw this other world that I could possibly be a part of. And as someone who is, you know, intelligent and is curious, you know, that quest for learning more about music is a very exciting thing, especially pre-internet. Mm-hmm. You know, I would buy magazines just to look for names of bands I'd never heard of before so I could try to find out what they sounded like. So that mm-hmm. that level of discovery was a huge part of how I grew as a person. And I played music myself, not very well, and eventually realized I couldn't make music that I myself liked, and that was a hard thing to recognize. And so then I began, you know, to write and, you know, use my ability to be pretty strong with words and to talk about records that I liked. But at a certain point, that sort of gets to be not enough. It's not, you know, emotionally fulfilling.
Since there was some type of frustration with your career prior to starting Kickstarter, to what extent did you start the company because of that, you know, you're having itchy feet to do something else versus really having a visceral interest, a holistic interest in the company?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely wholly a strong, genuine interest in what we do. I mean, it really is it. But, you know, it's not hard to look at the music industry and think this is not going to be here for very long. And, you know, I look at my very good friends who are still in that world, and not many of them are employed anymore. And so, you know, you're watching the sand leave the hourglass, and, you know, you're starting to think, I need to get out of here. So certainly that was in the air. But, you know, the Kickstarter is without question the greatest thing I've ever had the privilege to do with my life. And I don't know if I'll ever have the opportunity to do something so good again.
Your co-founder, Perry Chen, had the original idea for Kickstarter. You met him randomly at a restaurant in Brooklyn. What was that first encounter like?
Perry first had the idea in 2002. He's from New York originally, and he moved back to New Orleans, where he also went to college. And he went there, and he was trying to put on a concert. And he didn't have the money to do it. It was going to cost, you know, a lot of money up front to make it happen. And out of that, you know, he wished that there was some way he could know beforehand how many people were interested. If a certain number were interested, the show could happen because there were enough people. If there weren't, then the show wouldn't happen. And just this very simple trigger. And that was really the origin of Kickstarter right there. And so then in 2005, fall of 2005, there's a restaurant in Williamsburg, Brooklyn called Diner, and it's a nice restaurant. And I used to go there a lot, and Perry was a waiter there. And we got to be friends, and, you know, eventually one day he mentioned this idea he had. And, you know, he mentioned it to me because at the time my day job was working on the web in an editorial way, but I worked on the internet. And so that, you know, that meant I knew more about the web than he did, and so I could help him with this idea. So he shared this concept to me of this trigger that people decide for themselves what gets funded and what happens. And so, you know, I could see the merit of it, although I was a little nervous about it at first too, because I thought, well, this is American Idol. This isn't how you create great art. But as we talked it through more, just thinking of all those niches and enclaves in the world that just get ignored, but there is a support system there and a fan base there and all that who could decide for themselves. And then about a year later, we met Charles, who I mentioned before, our third founder. And Charles was more technical than either of us. He was a designer, but we still didn't have that core tech team. And that took a while to put together. So from the moment of really working on this in a very concentrated way to the site's launch, there's 4 years in between there.
What did you do to support yourself in those 4 years?
Well, I still had my day job. I was working at a music service called eMusic at the time. So I was doing that during the day, and at night I was working on this. Perry quit waiting. I mean, he was full-time trying to make Kickstarter happen. And he had some savings, and he lives light anyway. And same with Charles. You know, there's no way this doesn't happen if the two of them aren't working at this full-time and refusing to let this fail. I mean, there were numerous opportunities for us to quit. And there are times where, you know, empirically maybe we should have, but there was a persistence and a stubbornness that saw it through.
What were some turning points in those early days before the site launched that you thought, you know what, actually we're going to stick with this? And by the way, it was inexpensive for you because you were doing your other job anyway.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I had more of a safety net, and that was a source of conflict for sure. You know, the one guy who doesn't quit his job, but I just, you know, I had no money and no way to hack it. And I just wasn't ready for that jump. And so there are a number of milestones, good and bad. I mean, the biggest mistake that we made, and a mistake that I think a lot of people probably now are making, is that we tried to outsource the development of the site. So we ourselves did not know how to code. So we went to outside firms and hired them to code the site. And, you know, we were repeatedly told by the few people we met in the tech world that this is a terrible idea, this never works. Like, this never works out. And our reaction to that was, whatever, old man, you know, what do you know? it's different for us. You don't know how it is these days. And we really believed that. And then we realized after going down that path two or three different times and it not working out in really significant ways, that we realized that this was true. So a big turning point there was we met a woman named Sunny Bates. And Sunny is a Uber connector. She's the fastest talker you will ever meet. She lives here in the city. And she's just a lovely lovely, lovely woman. Sunny shares a dog walker with a friend of Perry's from college, and so we met Sunny through that, and we became just the, you know, the two downtown boys that she got to help out, and she really liked us immediately, and we just were blown away by her, and she's just a force. Mm-hmm. And we didn't know anybody, and so we told her our idea, and we were these, you know, two earnest guys with a piece of paper, and she was like, I'll take you around. I'll introduce you. So we were able to talk to people that we definitely would not have otherwise.
Who are some of the people whom you got to talk to and whom you engaged as a result of your connection with Sunny?
Yeah, like a really important one would be Katarina Fake, who is the founder of Flickr and founder of Hunch. Through Katarina, we were introduced to Andy Bayo, and Andy was an early advisor of ours and our CTO for a little while. Andy founded a site called upcoming.org in the early 2000s that was sold to Yahoo. He runs a blog called waxy.org, which is one of the best blogs on the web. He's basically the internet's resident nice guy. And so Andy brought us a lot of credibility when we launched and when people first covered us. I think TechCrunch wrote about us the day we launched. I think they said Andy Bayo's new startup. You know, he wasn't a founder. He was involved. But, you know, we would take it. You know, it's great to be associated with him. Mm-hmm. And he also helped us find technical talent. So, mm-hmm. you know, a hard task when you're not technical yourself is you meet someone and you have no idea of how to tell how good they are. So that was a big help. And basically, just for the moment we met Sunny, there was momentum.
Right. And you also have gotten support from people like Jack Dorsey, one of the Twitter founders. Is it financial support, among other things?
Yeah. He's an angel investor. We have a few really interesting angel investors, him, Joshua Schechter, who founded Delicious, and Katarina, who I mentioned, and Fred Wilson and Union Square Ventures are our primary backers.
We talk about, you know, crowdsourcing. Did you in any way feel like, oh, as I'm starting a company related to crowdsourcing, that's what I'm doing myself, is getting a crowd of people kind of funding my business?
Well, it's funny. When we would go around with the idea and we were just, you know, a couple people with a piece of paper, people inevitably would suggest, why don't you kickstart Kickstarter, you know, get people to put the money in and create the company that way. And SEC regulations prevent any exchange of equity on a case like that. But we did take that tact in the sense that we thought, let's get as many people as possible who we think will believe in the idea, who can be advocates for us, and let's get them to put in, you know, just a small amount of money. So that's definitely been a conscious approach that we've taken because, you know, one of the big ideas of Kickstarter is that a community could be a great sense of support and encouragement, and they can spread your word far, you know, spread word about your project far and wide, and we definitely thought very hard about that.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Yancey Strickler, co-founder of Kickstarter. We'll hear more from Yancey coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Yancey Strickler, co-founder of Kickstarter, a leading crowdfunding site. The company enables the public to fund creative projects related to film, food, design, and music. So if you're a musician who wants to create an independent album, you can go to Kickstarter, describe your project, how much money you need, and hope that visitors to the site will contribute. Yancey co-founded the company in 2009 with Perry Chen and Charles Adler. There's a book by James Surowiecki called The Wisdom of Crowds, where the more independent people you have in a population, the more accurate an answer or an outcome will be. To what extent was that kind of ringing in your ear when you were getting this off the ground, if at all?
We read it. I mean, that came out at the time that we were working on this, and it was certainly intriguing. You know, it's nice to get that pop psychology reinforcement for what it is you're thinking about.
But that's all that it was.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we were driven by a few different things. I mean, a sort of a core motivation was this acknowledgement of the fact that for an idea to have any value in culture, it had to generate money. That ideas that did not, in the end, generate revenue for someone else were considered valueless. You could not get a loan for those ideas. You could not get a venture capitalist to invest. You could not get a film studio to be, you know, to finance that. A record label would be scared of it. Everyone's just looking for a return on investment because they're businesses. But yet, you know, 99% of ideas are just ideas. It's a thing in your head that you want to have exist in the real world. If it makes you money, great. No one's going to, you know, cry about that. But in the end, you just want the thing to happen. You want that personal satisfaction. So we thought, you know, we could construct a place that functions differently, where ideas are judged based on the passion of the person behind it, the quality of their craft, the connection with their audience, and what the audience itself thinks. You know, the means of doing that was almost secondary to that idea. So, you know, we get called a crowdfunding site accurately. You know, that's sort of the term the web has come up with to describe these kinds of things. But that's not a word that's anywhere on our website. It's not a word that's ever spoken about in our office. It's not a word that we ever talked about leading up to this. I mean, I could care less about crowdfunding. It's a mechanism. You know, really, it's this bigger idea that matters. This crowdfunding thing is just a means to get there.
Right. You are enabling creators to create regardless of what a market might say.
Absolutely.
How does Kickstarter work?
So Kickstarter funding is all or nothing. So I create a project. I say how much money I need to complete it, and I give myself an amount of time to reach it. We suggest 30 days. That's the typical thing that people do. So we need $5,000 in 30 days. Now, if that person is able to raise that $5,000 or more by the time of that deadline, at that point, everyone is charged, and that person gets their money, and they go and they do their thing. If they come up short of their goal, then no one is charged at all, and everyone just walks away like nothing happened. Now, people choose to back projects because they get something in exchange. So it's not a tip jar. It's not a donation platform. So if I give you $10, I get $10 of something back, a copy of the CD, a copy of the book. For higher amounts, you offer, you know, more experimental things or experiential things. So I'll name a character after you, or I'll come do a reading at your house, or we'll play a private show, or you get a walk-on role in the film. People are able to offer whatever it is that they want to do. And so 44% of projects thus far have reached their goal successfully.
Can you talk to me about some of those people who have pitched their project online? What are some of your favorite ones?
There's a project that we had early on by a woman named Emily Richmond, and she's an artist from LA. And as part of this project, she is sailing around the world alone. It will take her 2 years to circumnavigate the globe alone, and which is a crazy thing to do. And so one of her rewards, the things that she offered, was for $15, at some point on her trip, she would take a Polaroid picture. And next time she got into port, she would mail it to you from wherever she was. And about 4 months ago, 3 months ago, I got an envelope in the mail with strange stamps on it. And I opened it up, and there was a map. And written on one side of the map was my name. And I unfolded it, and tucked inside was a Polaroid picture. And the background was the ocean, you know, faded Polaroid. In the foreground, a jungle and a beach. And on the map, she had circled the island where she was sitting in the South Pacific. And on the other side, she'd written a letter describing what she saw as she took the photo. Mm-hmm. And I got this for $15. And this is something that is romantic and that has enormous, you know, emotional meaning to me. And I'm just a stranger on the internet, you know. And so that sort of thing can happen.
You contributed $15. How much was she looking to raise altogether?
She's trying to raise $7,000, and she raised about $7,500, something like that. Another one I really like, I like these sort of quixotic projects. They're where my heart kind of lies. There's another one called The Mysterious Letters, and it's by a guy and a girl who are both British. Their names are Michael and Linka, and they had the very simple idea that they wanted to write everyone in the world a handwritten letter. And they were going to start with some small, specific towns. Mm. So they did a project on Kickstarter to do one in a neighborhood of Pittsburgh called Polish Hill. And so on one day, 623 residents of Polish Hill received letters from Michael and Lenka. Again, all, you know, very idiosyncratic. And predictably, people freaked out and got very scared, and it got reported to the FBI and became a big story there. And people started hanging up signs around Polish Hill that said, "Don't worry, it was an art project." There was an amazing story in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette of the reporter interviewing the shop owner, this older woman, and she was said that she thought it was a nuisance that this letter got, and that she thought it was scary and it could be terrorism, these whole ideas. And in the story it said, after the reporter writing, "After I explained to her that it was an art project, the woman removed the letter from the wastebasket and carefully smoothed it out." I just thought that was wonderful.
When the public contributes money to support a project, it's not investing. And that's because it's illegal in the United States, although internationally regulation is different. Was that a roadblock initially, or was it your intent initially just to have people contribute?
The intent from the beginning was to not have any equity or any points or anything change hands. And that was the intent even before we knew it would be against the law, even if we thought the other way. I mean, the thinking there was that if we're asking people to look at these things and try to guess whether or not it will be a hit, you're just recreating the same mouse cage that we already have, where people are just trying to get, you know, looking to make a buck off of something. And if someone's being motivated by a royalty check in 3 years for $13, what is that? Is that a better world? And so we always like this idea of it being about experiences and products that you get in exchange. Mm-hmm. So yes, there's never any sort of equity or you know, financial return that swaps hands on Kickstarter. It's strictly forbidden.
What other forms of crowd support has there been in history? Is there a precedent for this?
There is. I mean, what's funny is that this is not novel at all in a way. You know, the original forms that art was primarily produced was through patronage, and it was patronage by the church, by royalty, by the Medici, by rich people, basically, in general. And Beethoven would perform a lot of his symphonies this way, where he would say, I will only perform this when the hall has sold out, and that's the only way this work will be debuted. You get your name in the program. I mean, it's the exact same thing as now. Whitman used to publish some of his books in that same way. In the front of the books, he'd list all the people who helped pay for this first run of printing. And so there are hundreds of examples of art being made in this way. And then right around the middle of the 20th century, we started to switch this idea of corporations subsidizing, commoditizing art, and that being the primary way that art was funded.
While this crowd support has been in existence for centuries, to what extent do you think the appetite is ripe for it now? I mean, you've been enabled by Twitter and Facebook existing, but how much have they facilitated what you're trying to do?
The lifeblood of our site is social media. At this point, Kickstarter is mentioned on Twitter about every 8 seconds, I believe it is. So people are just talking about it all the time, talking about their projects, and it's how things are getting discovered. When we were working on this in 2005, there wasn't a Twitter. I guess Facebook probably existed, but I'm not a Harvard grad, so I was not allowed to be a part of it. I mean, it was a MySpace world at that point, and you know, I'm not really sure. I think we had a MySpace widget idea for how people would spread the word, but it was unclear. And so this whole world has grown around this that's allowed this to exist in a much easier way.
Accidentally.
Yeah, accidentally.
What do you think the appetite is for something like this in other countries?
We have no way of knowing. I think that until you see it and interact with it, a lot of what we do sounds very utopian and maybe a little naive. And I think we are a little naive, but we're all right with that. And, you know, we think about this the way that Twitter or Facebook have grown, where, you know, when your first friend started a Twitter account, you probably made fun of them. You know, you thought that's ridiculous. Like, why would you ever do such a thing? And then over time, you realize the purpose that it serves, and it becomes a part of your life as well. And this is this gradual socialization of these new kinds of services, these new means of expression. And we're on that same kind of timeline, and we have that same level of patience for this. I feel sure that with time that this can be a thing that everyone will feel comfortable with.
So artists have this reputation of feeling uncomfortable talking about the business side of their work, yet your site is all about artists connecting with potential supporters or sources of money. Can you talk to me a little bit about that dichotomy?
I mean, you're saying out loud how much money you need to do something. And the way the site is structured, it's not just about money. It's more about the thing that you're doing. But yet, we're all very uncomfortable talking about money in public. We'd rather talk about anything else than money. And for artists in particular, you know, you're just running for money. You don't want to think about it. That's part of the point. And so there is that level of discomfort, and there's that hurdle that we have to get over. And I'm incredibly sympathetic to it. I mean, I feel very similarly. And I also think that people aren't sure about putting themselves out there in the world. You know, J.D. Salinger would be a terrible Kickstarter creator. You know, it's not for everybody. But I think that with time, people can see that this is about more than just the cash. It's about opportunity. It's about building an audience, all those other things.
Along those lines, you know, I asked you prior to the interview, well, how much money have you raised? And you don't want people to know that, which is compatible with this whole artist mentality of wanting to keep that separate. But that doesn't necessarily work anymore. I mean, you see artists, they have to be great marketers, and it's in their best interest.
It's true. You know, for us, in talking about our own financial backing and our own, you know, things like that, we don't view it as being terrifically interesting. So we just didn't feel like that added anything to our story, that it didn't feel like us. It was someone else's story of us.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Yancey Strickler, co-founder of Kickstarter, a company that enables the public to fund creative projects. Do you know anybody else with the name Yancey, incidentally?
I've heard tell. There was an NFL player named Yancey. There's an actress named Yancey. But I've never met anyone face-to-face. It's a Southern last name, traditionally. I was named after a family friend. I hated my name for a lot of my life. And only when, I guess it was in high school, I decided to embrace it. But yeah, it's an unusual one.
So going back to the early days of the company, what was more challenging for you than you thought? I mean, you've had kind of a charmed existence, having the support of the media and this strong network of people helping you out.
Well, those people were not there always. You know, when we launched, it was just us. We were a team of five. We had no one of any weight behind us. We had no big investment, and when we would go around to venture capital firms and talk to people about our idea, people did not like it. People did not respond to it. I think that we had that 4-year gap where the site couldn't launch, and it was not a happy period. And we would have launched that site in 2006 if we could have, but we couldn't. And you know, you wake up in the morning and you think, is today the day that the three people in Palo Alto with this exact same idea, they launched theirs because they worked a little bit harder, you know, and you have these kinds of anxieties, and no one was getting paid, and it was, you know, it was bootstrapping all the way. You know, I think that there was a lot of emotional toll of especially me having a full-time job and my partners being both fully committed. That caused a lot of stress and a lot of tension, as you can probably understand. Now the problems are interesting. Now the problems are growth.
You founded the company with Perry Chen and Charles Adler, and they were working on the company full-time, and you weren't. So why did they keep you on board as a co-founder if you weren't carrying your weight?
That's a good question. I don't know. We're friends, so that helps. It was not a great period. I don't know the answer to that.
You have a part of your site devoted to product design, and that has been somewhat controversial. Can you elaborate on that?
Sure. So we started Kickstarter as a platform for creative projects. We meant that pretty broadly. So that's film, music, tech, comics, you know, dance, all kinds of things like that. And then in September 2010, we had a project from two guys in New York named Dan and Tom, and it was a project called The Glyph. And it's a tripod mount for an iPhone 4, and it's a little simple piece of rubber. And they put together a video where they explained how they designed this thing, and they had a very clever sort of commercial for it. And it was a very, very well-done project. And they put it in the design category, and it was a design project, and they were trying to raise $10,000, and they raised about $140,000 very quickly. And the project is basically functioning as a pre-order mechanism. People were buying the Glyph from them. And that was the first time we'd had a project like that. And it opened the floodgates to a lot of product design kind of things. And quite a few of those were terrible, and we turned most of those down. But at one point, we had another big one come through by a man named Scott Wilson, who's a designer who lives in Chicago, who designed the Xbox Kinect, among a lot of other big things. And he had a project called the TikTok. And what he did is he designed a watch band that would turn an iPod Nano into a wristwatch. And he was looking to raise $15,000 to do it. And after a month, the project ended with him raising $945,000. And so for his project, that was functioning as a pre-order mechanism, and some 14,000 people bought this thing. But more than that, they also got a story that they were part of. They were part of the creation of this phenomenon. I mean, it was international news, this project. And all those people got bragging rights and got to be a part of it. But it's also more commercial than the kinds of things that we have traditionally supported on Kickstarter. I mean, our biggest category is documentary film. Documentaries have raised, you know, $15 million on Kickstarter. And something like this, you know, the creation of like a gadget seems a little bit divorced from that. You know, because of the success of the TikTok and other projects like it, we've had a real influx of proposals of people looking to do these kinds of things. And we lit in almost everything at this point after a lot of internal debate. We sort of opened wider to this, but we're still not entirely sure how we feel about it. You know, we like this idea of Kickstarter being a place where you put an idea into the world and the crowd decides, right, whether or not it should happen or it shouldn't. But yet we're not a fully open platform. We don't allow everything. So this has really pushed some of our philosophy a little bit. And to be honest, we're not entirely sure where we stand.
To some extent, these people, even if they have the commercial incentive, are still creators and they're still being creative. So
yeah, just because they happen to work in a different medium than one I feel more comfortable in, you know, that's just as much about my bias as it is anything. And we're very aware of that. Mm-hmm. And we're also aware that, you know, when we started Kickstarter, it was ours. It was this idea we had to protect. But with each day, it's a little bit less ours. And it's more just a thing that exists on its own in the world that a lot of people contribute to. So, you know, you even have to question how much a voice do we have the right to have about mm-hmm. this thing.
What do you do outside of work that gives you pleasure right now?
Right now, it's primarily riding my bike. But, you know, outside of that, I read. I read, you know, 3 or 4 books a week probably.
What 2 books have you read this week?
Well, let's see. Right now I'm reading the Tom Shales Oral History of ESPN, which I find fascinating and I actually find to be a really good startup book because it's about the origins of this, what is now a huge, huge company just based on being founded by 2 men and basically how they lost control of the company and how it's become this other big thing. And then I'm reading The Bridge, the David Remnick biography of Obama. I recently read The Medium is the Massage by Malcolm McLaren, which is a classic 60s sort of post-Marxist theory book about sort of the philosophy of media. That's amazing. I read that 3 times in a day. It's a little 100-page book. And another one that was I really loved, I've read multiple times, is You Are Not a Gadget by Jerron Lanier, which is a really good book about sort of some philosophies of technology. And he takes a very sort of pessimistic view in a lot of ways about, you know, what technology has done for us. And I enjoy reading those kinds of opinions.
He advises Microsoft.
I believe he does. He also invented virtual reality, and he does. He's a very smart man with some crazy ideas.
Yes, and he has great dreadlocks.
He does.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Yancey Strickler, co-founder of Kickstarter. Coming up, we'll meet Mark Ramadan, co-founder of Sir Kensington's, a condiment company. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Mark Ramadan, co-founder of Sir Kensington's, a ketchup company. Mark and his co-founder Scott Norton thought, why shouldn't there be a gourmet alternative to Heinz ketchup, and started tinkering with recipes in their off-campus apartment while they were students at Brown University. Sir Kensington's was launched in 2010, and the product is available in stores throughout the United States, including Williams-Sonoma, Dean & DeLuca, and Whole Foods. The product is also available in more than 500 restaurants and hotels. Sir Kensington's also makes other condiments, including mustard and mayo. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'd like to start in September 2004 with an article written in the New Yorker magazine by Malcolm Gladwell called The Ketchup Conundrum. Basically, the gist of it was that while mustards enjoyed a variety of flavors and various companies made them, ketchup could not share that same diversity. Only Heinz had kind of this perfect blend of sweetness and sourness and bitterness and saltiness, in addition to mouthfeel, which is called umami. Can you tell me about your first encounter with that article?
Yeah, we had this idea of ketchup long after that article came out. We didn't read it in 2004. We were in high school and we weren't highbrow enough. And we had this idea when we were seniors in college in 2007, 2008. The article was brought to our attention. We read it and we thought it was very interesting. I think, you know, in many ways, the food world is very different than where it was in 2004. You know, in 2004, Chobani didn't exist. Coconut water didn't exist in America. And so many things have changed since then. So, you know, when we were reading it, we had a very different perspective on what's possible. We thought that he made a lot of great points around product. Ketchup is a very nostalgic flavor. The mouthfeel, like you said, those things are really innate in people. What stood out to us is that there wasn't a lot of discussion around brand, whereas Grey Poupon really has a fantastic brand and was, he mentions, as sort of a breakout star of the mustard category. There weren't, we didn't really perceive there to be a lot of ketchup brands that were doing something interesting in the same way.
He talks about this concept amplitude, which basically is a balance of flavors, and that Heinz had a high amplitude. And I have to admit something embarrassing, which is that the article came out a month before I was married, and I thought when I was giving a speech at my wedding, what am I going to say? And I used this concept of amplitude about my husband in my wedding speech.
That sounds perfect. Yeah, completely perfect. Yeah. You know, amplitude is present in everything that we eat, everything we consume, right? It's sort of, in the way that it's talked about in the article, it's sort of how intense can the flavors be and how often do you want to keep going back to that flavor or how long does it take you to get tired of it? Mm-hmm. And I think Coca-Cola has a lot of that, has a lot of amplitude. You don't taste one thing in Coke. You taste many things. And so for me, having something that has high amplitude means it's balanced.
The article wasn't the germ or the inspiration for you to launch the company. How did you get the idea to start the ketchup company while you were at Brown?
Yeah. Well, the legendary answer is that we were reading about Sir Kensington in history class, and he was part of the British aristocracy and quite a culinaire. And there was a long-lost recipe that he had sort of helped develop after he went to a dinner party at the home of Catherine the Great, and he was served a ketchup that was subpar, so he needed to make his own, and we brought that back to life. Mm-hmm. The real story is that we had the idea to start the company just in the course of normal conversations around food. I mean, we were both... I have a Lebanese and British family. He has an Armenian family. And so there was always cooking going on growing up and lots of family feasts. And food was always a very central part of our lives. But we were both econ majors. So we were always talking about food ideas and ways to sort of find the intersection there. And we were just saying how weird it was that if you go to the grocery store, you're overwhelmed with choice, you know, whether it's cereal or yogurt or salsa or milk. But in this one category that is in 97% of American homes, we didn't think there was any choice.
By the way, we talk about Heinz as this, you know, behemoth incumbent. But Henry Heinz was a maverick of sorts. You know, in the late 19th century, there was a preservative in ketchup called benzoate. And he contended that this was actually not good for your health. And he replaced the preservative with vinegar, basically pickling the tomatoes. And he won out. But it was because of his moxie that Heinz was born.
Yeah, I mean, the story of H.J. Heinz is incredible. And we're lucky that we don't live in the world of the late 19th century. The food world was scary. I mean, before truth in advertising laws and before sort of consumer protection, that people were putting all sorts of stuff in food, making all sorts of claims. And food was, in general, not super safe. And H.J. Heinz was really one of the first entrepreneurs to take food safety very seriously. And that was the origin of the glass bottle, which was he wanted to make sure people knew that he was proud to show what was inside. And so I think that, that resonates with us.
Heinz is this iconic Americana brand, and you sought out to do something distinctly different by making this absurdly highbrow, making fun of yourself, but foodie-oriented condiment. When we say that you tinkered with recipes during college, tell me more about that.
Yeah, so it was the spring semester of our senior year. Neither of us were writing any sort of thesis, so we had plenty of time. And we just started Googling ketchup recipes. And we had really no cooking background at all. I think at most I had cooked pasta in college, and Scott had probably cooked less than that. But he had an off-campus apartment with a stove. Ketchup, to make it, in theory it's easy. In practice, it was extremely difficult. We didn't even have aprons, so we cut up trash bags to use as aprons. We didn't have proper gloves, so we used oven mitts. You know, we didn't have any pot bigger than a saucepan, so it took us weeks and weeks. And I think that off-campus apartment still smells like tomatoes. And we developed 8 different recipes that we thought were pretty good. And we hosted a series of tasting parties with our friends. And our first tasting party was the night of the biggest blizzard that Brown had seen in years. But people showed up with snow pants under their dresses, and they helped us taste all these ketchups and give us their feedback.
What is a Kensington kiss?
So Kensington kiss was the result of not having proper protection while cooking ketchup. We didn't have, you know, the right aprons, gloves, or whatever. So a Kensington kiss is what we called the burn marks on our skin when the hot tomato ketchup would boil off and splatter all over us.
So this is senior year of college, and you both went off to do different things prior to starting the company. You worked at McKinsey in New York after graduation, and Scott went on this bicycle ride throughout the Middle East and Europe. At what point did you come back to this idea of starting the company?
As we were graduating, the idea was sort of what we thought was coming to a close. We made two formulas that we thought were great. We had a big launch party, sold all the jars we made, and that was going to be it. But we had a lot of friends who were saying, this is a cool idea. You should at least keep working on it. So actually, over the course of 2008 to 2010, we worked nights and weekends on Skype and however we could get in touch, really putting all the puzzle pieces together. And then in 2010, we had gotten it to a point where we felt like it was just waiting for someone to take it over. So I quit my job in June of 2010, and he joined in October.
We talk about the legendary start of Sir Kensington's. How did you come up with the idea of being tongue-in-cheek and being, you know, what you called absurdly highbrow in getting the concept off the ground?
When I was growing up, I was always attracted to brands that had personalities. That doesn't necessarily mean literal figurative personalities like a, you know, like a Mr. Peanut. But I think brands need to make statements, and Heinz clearly makes a statement. It stands for childhood, it stands for nostalgia, it stands for fun, and really, it stands for Americana. And we didn't want to go right up against that. And I think, you know, as much as food is about quality and taste, it's also about entertainment. So we didn't want to make anything that was too, we didn't want to take ourselves too seriously. So Sir Kensington evolved as this character that hearkened to British quality and British cuisine, which in some ways isn't looked at as the best cuisine in the world, but it's certainly looked at as sort of like high tea and, you know, it's the origin of a lot of things fancy. And Sir Kensington was this character that personified these sort of tongue-in-cheek ideas that you could have quality even in the lowliest of things.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Mark Ramadan, co-founder of Sir Kensington's, a condiment company that got its start by making a ketchup that hoped to be a gourmet alternative to Heinz. What is the history of ketchup?
Ketchup actually is a 500-year-old condiment. It started as a fish sauce in Southeast Asia. It's originally a Chinese word. I think it's pronounced ketsiop. And it sort of migrated with the spice trade from Southeast Asia through Central Asia. And it eventually incorporated tomatoes, which are a new world crop. The tomatoes are from Peru. The Europeans brought tomatoes back to Europe, needed a way to preserve them, and ketchup eventually made its way to America.
So in 2010, you and Scott decide to launch the company officially. You debuted at the Fancy Food Show. And how pivotal was that for you?
For us, that was that little four-foot table that I was standing behind with my sister made all the difference. That's where we met Whole Foods. That's where we met Dean and DeLuca. That's where we met Williams-Sonoma. And I think in many ways we were incredibly lucky that they stopped by because we didn't know what we were doing. We didn't know how pricing worked. We didn't know what distribution was. I mean, we didn't even have a warehouse. The first order of product arrived at my apartment doorstep, and it was a pallet. I didn't even know what a pallet was. I was in a doorman building at the time. Doorman called and said, "You have a delivery." I said, "Oh, great. You can just put it in the packages room." And he's like, "No, no, no. This is thousands of pounds of I don't know what." And so I had to come back and I sort of helped him unload it and put it all in my apartment. So I had a wall of ketchup in the apartment at the time.
What was harder for you initially than you thought it might be?
Well, sales were hard, still are hard. And so we were taking our cases of product door to door up and down streets of New York to places like Murray's Cheese, places like the Chelsea Market. You know, but it was hard, though, because people are busy. They see a million products a day. It's only gotten worse. These jars of ketchup were heavy, so I had them in a like a rolling suitcase. And I would go into these stores, and the stores would be filled with people. I mean, it's Manhattan, so there's no room for anything. And I'm in there with my suitcase trying to get them to taste this or see this. And they, you know, they just say, "I'll leave a sample and I'll call you back." And the nice people do. But most people, even if they are nice, are too busy to call you back. Figuring out that you have to sort of be persistent while still being nice was a tricky balance to find.
Any interesting anecdotes about, you know, approaching Murray's Cheese or, you know, you mentioned Chelsea Market or, I don't know, anything that sticks out?
Well, I think the first thing is our very first New York retailer was Chelsea Market Baskets, which is a store still there, great store in Chelsea Market. And he was willing to put it up on shelf. We had most of the product in my apartment. We had some product in a warehouse near where Scott and Brandon were from in Northern California. And so our first attempt to ship, we didn't know that you had to pack glass properly. And we would get these irate calls. You know, I have a box that's bleeding ketchup. There's glass everywhere. What are you doing? And so I had to start hand delivering every week, you know, these boxes of ketchup all around the city because we had no other solution.
How did you finance the company in the early days?
In the early days, we put in our own money. It was me, Scott, Brandon, and there was a fourth partner named Wynn, who was also a college friend of ours. But as soon as I decided to leave my job and do this full time, we started to raise a bit of money from family and friends. We tried to raise money from people who were not just supportive, but had done something like this before. So some of our investors have also invested in brands like Pop Chips and Vita Coco, and we've tried to raise money from people who know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And so to the degree that we can continue to raise from people like that, that's going to help.
What are some mistakes that were made that perhaps, you know, they helped with?
It hasn't all been easy. We've made a lot of mistakes. One of those mistakes is saying yes to every store that wanted to stock us right away. It was certainly in the early days just an amazing compliment. So we said yes to everyone. And so very quickly we had product in Arizona, in Texas, in Maine, in New York, California, all around the country. And I think the dirty secret of the food world is you have to be ready to support that. Mm. You know, things don't just fly off the shelf. And so we learned the hard way over the course of 2 years. We were getting into more and more stores. We weren't really paying attention to if once it got on the shelf, was it getting off the shelf? Did anyone know about it? Was anyone willing to pay? And so we had to go through a period of really pulling back. And it was actually one of our board members who has done this before who said you should really lean into your best customers. And for us, that was Whole Foods.
What are the sorts of things you did other than, you know, stand there and demo, allow people to try the product?
Stores, in many ways, make their money off of vendors, not off of the people who are buying stuff in their stores. So a lot of stores, they'll charge what are called slotting fees, which are, you know, you have to pay just a flat fee to get your product on the shelf. But then to move it, you can do things like demos. But also, anytime you walk into a store and you see a display, you know, at the end of an aisle or sort of by checkout, that's usually paid for. And so being able to have that kind of placement makes you a little more attractive, certainly more visible, because it's also on sale. We found that that has the biggest impact on sales. And also hardest to get, because everyone's done this math. Everyone wants those kinds of displays.
Do you have any better answers for why Heinz dominated the market for so long, other than this amplitude answer that Malcolm Gladwell has?
I think that Heinz built their brand brilliantly by being ubiquitous. You know, something like 70 to 75% of all ketchup is consumed in food service, not in retail. So food service is basically anywhere you get ketchup for free. Restaurants, hotels, travel, schools, whatever. And it's usually Heinz. And so when you go to buy ketchup at home, you're going to buy what you're familiar with. And so for us, from the very, very beginning, it was always about how do we work with restaurants and how do we be omnipresent?
You're in more than 500 restaurants across the United States. What are one or two stories about getting the ketchup, getting your ketchup into one of those restaurants?
Our big break, I would say, on the restaurant side is working with PJ Clark's. I mean, they're an institution for burgers, and they've been serving the burger since 1884 with Heinz. I mean, the chef, his name is Mike DeFonso, phenomenally nice guy, very busy guy. And this was really our first lesson in how to sell in restaurants. There's no sort of process there. So we showed up. He tasted it. He said it was great. Said he would call us. Didn't call us. Busy guy. So actually for like 4 months straight, we would just keep showing up at his doorstep. And he would always laugh and he'd say, "You guys, what do you want again?" And then eventually he said, "I want to do it, but my boss won't let me," the owner, this guy, Phil Scotty. And then, you know, for another 6 months, we were going back and over, trying to get a meeting with him, kept getting blown off. And then finally, he allowed us 5 minutes in his office. And the first thing he said to us, and he was this like legendary guy in our life, right? Almost a year trying to reach this man, Phil. He turns to us and he says, "You are the most f-ing persistent guys I have ever met. What do you have for me?" And so we told him our story very briefly, and he was a smoker at the time, and we gave him an engraved Zippo lighter with PJ Clark's on it, and it was really sort of the way to his heart. And we're now very close to him and his wife Thea, who's been like a godmother to us, and it all happened, and it was all because it was non-traditionally persistent.
I noticed that you're married. You have a ring. When did that happen?
Well, what's funny is I spent 2008 to 2010 at McKinsey desperately trying to find a girlfriend, and I couldn't. And the moment that I quit to start Sir Kensington's, I decided now I really should be single so I can really focus my time on building Sir Kensington's. And then at the Fancy Food Show, I met Rachel, who is now my wife.
What was she doing at the Fancy Food Show?
At the time, she was a partner at a design firm. Hmm. And so they were looking at packaging and trying to find cool, interesting new clients. And she and her boss had stopped by. They were too expensive for us, so we started dating instead. And now we're married.
What might I not know about you? What do you enjoy doing outside of work?
Well, I love spending time with Rachel. I also love cocktail culture. I was very briefly a bartender at a bar downtown called White Star, and I learned how to chisel ice from Sasha Petrosky, who's the founder of Milk and Honey, the seminal sort of pre-prohibition or prohibition-style cocktail bar in New York. And I started doing these bar nights in my apartment while I was at McKinsey. The whole idea was to create a space that was fun and was lubricated, but not insane. You know, wasn't sort of a 10 shots for $5 kind of place, but also not the kind of place where you had to whisper. And over time, it took on sort of a life of its own, and I created a menu, and people were bringing people I had never met before, and it got up to something like 40 people, and I had almost 100 bottles of liquor in my apartment. And it lasted for almost a year, and it had a name. It was called Mark Bar. I have plans to have sort of an underground bar component to Rachel's Cafe when it finally launches.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Mark Ramadan, co-founder of Sir Kensington's. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.